Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 481. And I'm joined today by someone who, as we discuss, I've been wanting to have on for a long time. And just our diaries haven't matched up. It's been weird. I've been in talks with agents and all sorts. And yeah, I'm glad we've finally done it. I'm joined today by Adam Kay, who is a wonderful comedian, a wonderful writer, and formerly a wonderful doctor. If this is going to hurt, his first book just went crazy a few years back and I loved it. I adored it. I then adored the TV show. And we talk about all of that. And I'm loving his new book, Undoctored. So we basically had a lot to talk about. And it's really interesting chatting with someone whose book blew up because of it was kind of like, if this is going to hurt, blew up because of the honest, often sad truths about working as a doctor and the lack of support in the NHS and things like that. And then we had the pandemic and everyone was out on the streets clapping for the NHS. And then a few years later, there's no pay rises. There's all sorts of lack of support again. So I don't know. It felt perfectly timed for this conversation. And it was worth the wait as well. I proper enjoyed this. As I mentioned, Adam is a wonderful comedian, speaker, writer. And as this comes out, there's still a few dates left on his current tour. So on November 3rd in Bournemouth, November 6th, Cambridge, November 9th, Nottingham, November 10th, Brighton, and November 14th, London, Apollo. Let's get on with the podcast, shall we? Obviously, before we do, we're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch, all reduced at the moment. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is where you can support on the Patreon for $1 a month. And twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipYo is where you can catch me on the regular, acting a fool, chatting with you guys and live streaming my little heart out. Let's get on with it. This is episode 481 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Adam Kay. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm here today with Adam Kay, who I tweeted yesterday evening as I was doing my prep about my excitement about this, because I've been wanting to have you on for about 5 years and we've come close a few times and it's just been timings and schedules on my part a lot of the time. So I'm pleased to be here chatting with you. How are you?
I'm really good. Yeah, I'm very excited about this as well. I'm a big fan.
Excellent, excellent. What's going on at the moment? Are you well? Are you calm? Are you, you know, in control of your life? Any of the above?
I'm well. I'm 4 out of 10 calm, which I think is, that's as high as my calm, that's as, right, as good as my calm gets.
Yeah.
And I'm never in control of my life, but no. I don't know how I'd react if I was. It's I went from one life where I was a doctor sort of doing incredible numbers of hours a week, you know, not having any say in my destiny whatsoever, work on Christmas Day or every night for a month or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now I'm living the freelance existence where you learn to say yes to everything at the start, yeah, when you're getting, yeah, nothing. And then you get, you know, I'm a bit lucky and now I get off of, you know, I'm sort of, life's all right, but I'm still very scared to say no, because what's, apart from, yeah, to your podcast, obviously, which I did, yeah, many, many times in a row. Scared to say no, in case that's the last time anyone ever asks me to do anything. And it doesn't seem to go away.
I completely understand it. It's such a weird industry for that, that even when you're doing well, I really get a, like, particularly since I've moved into acting, I'll get an audition come through and I'll be overwhelmed that they've even asked me to audition. What an absolute honour. And every now and then you have to sit back and go, no, this, like, you've done some good things, you're doing all right, like, you can pick the right things and it doesn't have to be a, oh, it's so kind of you to ask. It can be a bit more. No, we have value as well, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to make that mental switch, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. Well, before we get into your books all of your whole career, basically. I want to start by thanking you for naming your dog after me. Beautiful move. Tell me a little bit about Pip.
So she's an Airedale Terrier. You don't see a huge number of Airedale Terriers around. All Terriers sort of look the same, but Airedales are like the biggest model. Mm. It's like the Seven Series Terrier.
Yeah.
And and she's about two and a bit now. She was a lockdown dog.
Amazing.
I know a lot of people made a lockdown dog mistake, but I think one of the best things that's ever happened to me. And not just in terms of the companionship, or the picking up shit, but it's the fact that it forces me to get out the house. Do at least an hour a day of wandering with the dog, which is really good for my sort of general washing my brain out.
I'm exactly the same. Me and my partner got a lockdown dog, and the best thing ever, right? It's absolutely amazing. I think it speaks so highly of our low self-esteem that we go, well, the dog needs exercise and fresh air and food. And we didn't think that about ourselves.
Oh, no,
another living organism. All of that. We spent all our years just not giving ourselves that respect. But a dog, we're like, yeah, well, he needs to run. We need to get fresh air. We need to go to nice places. It's like, all right, that could have been for us all along.
Absolutely. And I have proper long conversations with the dog. I mean, they're pretty one-sided.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can do a proper 10-minute rant. And that's quite good as well for sort of the mental health side of things. Get a lot of stuff off my chest. Because I'm not talking to myself, obviously. I'm talking to my dog.
Exactly. I'm honestly, I think, the soppiest that I get when I'm alone with the dog. Because he'll just do something, it'll be really nice, and I'll just be so overwhelmed and give him all these compliments and just calm down, Pip. He doesn't care.
Also, I think some part of my brain does think she's a person, because I once thought I was once out doing something and I saw a squirrel or something, and I took a photo. I was like, I must text that to Pip. I'm like, no, I mustn't, that's deranged.
I love it. I've not had our dogs are called Finley, and I pray for the moment something happens and I think I'll have to tell Finley about that later. He'll love hearing about that'll be amazing. Well, to get onto you and your career, if this is going to her, absolutely blew me away. I read it over a series of solo visits to pizza restaurants in Portugal. I think I'd got sent a preview copy.
That's how it was designed to be read.
Yeah, I thought is what you'd kind of hoped.
Yeah, you've always got an image of your reader in your head, and for me, it's pizza restaurants in Portugal.
Every time it was nice Italian pizza, two bottles of Coke Zero, glass bottles, and your book, and I'd just sit there for ages, just reading and just in awe of the stories and everything you kind of.
I mean, there is a school of thought that says it could put you off your nice Italian pizza and glass bottle of Diet Coke.
Yeah, it goes to some places. And I guess, how was that to start to put all of that down? Because when you've lived through all of that, one of the things with any jobs like that or any industries really is you become numb to it. It becomes normal. It becomes the regular. At what point did you kind of go, I need to write all this down because this is fucking mad.
So I've kept diaries for a long, long, long time.
Right.
And I guess when I was writing this stuff down while I was doing the job, I don't quite know why I thought I was writing it down, but looking back at it, it was my way of coping. It was my pressure release valve, or it was my way of dealing with a crap day by focusing on the funny or the silly or the disgusting or whatever it is.
And there's an offloading element there, isn't there, of getting it written onto a page, right?
There is. It's a form of sharing. And it's not as good as, you know, as talking to someone about it, but doctors are sort of trained not to want to talk about it. And I've sort of come unstuck a bit as a result of keeping stuff in. But it jangles around my head a little bit less if I get it down on paper. And it is a coping mechanism of sorts, but, you know, it's not the perfect coping mechanism.
Yeah. So I guess obviously, I want to talk about your new book as well, but how was it when This Is Going to Hurt blew up in the way that it did? Because the new book, Undoctored, kind of talks a lot about the post-medicine, pre any real success kind of period. So that can be a tough period. Again, I want to talk a load about that later as someone who's toured and done all sorts of other stuff where you're just trying to get by. How was it when it blew up? Because it's multi-millions selling now, and it was just, yeah, it was the book of several, I was going to say of that year, but of several years, you know? So, yeah, how was it when it all clicked in and made sense?
I mean, it was just extraordinary. I'd have to have quite an ego on me to think it would, you know, sell anything like how it did. And I think that really just speaks to the fact that it was a love letter to the NHS, and I love the NHS, and clearly lots of other people love the NHS. Yeah. Plus, I guess we're a bit interested in like the unvarnished truth of someone's job. So we all know a bit about what we think a doctor does. We've all seen a doctor for whatever reason, but hearing the stuff when they're, you know, when they're off duty, or the stuff that you don't normally, I think there's a certain interest in. I mean, you only have to watch telly, it's all policemen and doctors, and I mean that's about half of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is,
in terms of the dramas.
And then there's that element of seeing a teacher outside of school, hearing these stories about what doctors are actually like and what actually goes on. It's like you don't hear that, as you touched upon. It's a profession where you're kind of encouraged to hold it all down and to keep it all in, and to not let any of that across. And it's a really weird one, man, because I've talked to a few different soldiers and stuff about that kind of thing, and I get it. For the function of the job, I get that that can be important. But for the person that is doing the job, it's really dangerous and really damaging. So it's a weird one. Like, I understand it, because that's your job and you can't be there going, oh, this has been a nightmare tonight. I mean, you can't. You have to present a calm and in control presence. You do.
I think it can be slightly damaging the way that doctors think their patients want them to be. Mm. So you're sort of trained as a doctor to present as totally infallible, because you're the person who's calculating a chemotherapy dose. Or you're the person who's making a millimeter accurate incision on a blood vessel or something. You think that that means that you have to be some kind of godlike person. Yeah. And then if you start believing that enough, you sort of stop thinking yourself as a human, the sort of person who gets sick and gets sad and has all their normal frailties and vulnerabilities, because, you know, that sort of person might make mistakes. But ultimately, everyone who's currently got the job title doctor at some point was just an idiot 18-year-old choosing some A-levels.
And often,
with no idea about what the job ahead of them was actually going to look like.
Yeah, completely. And it's interesting, because what we present is what we often draw out of others. So confidence and that control is good for someone who's nervous and about to go into a surgery. I took my dad in for a surgery recently, and I drove him in, and we were both, you know, it's a bit nervous. I left buzzing, because the doctor that came in was the most charming, confident guy I'd ever met. I was like, yeah, I do these all the time. I do like four of these a day. It was so casual about it.
Yeah, that's what you want to hear, isn't it? That's my bread and butter.
All right, it's not that big a deal. And again, I think that did really breed that affects a lot. So again, I can see the... I can see the positiveness of it.
Yeah, but that's a different kind of bedside manner. It's all acting. I worked as an actor when I was on the wards, just like you work as an actor now, except the difference is that if you're working on the wards, you're getting about £4 an hour. But but putting the patient at ease. So that person was using humour a bit. You know, this is the biggest day, you know, of your life for months and months.
Yeah.
For me, it's my bread and butter. I come here, I do loads of them, I go home, you know, I'll have forgotten about this. And that's
for me, it's 2 p.m. That's it. It's 2 p.m. Yeah. That's it. This is what I'm doing at 2. It's not a big deal.
And it's about pitching it right for the patient. And that doctor sounds brilliant, because he pitched it absolutely right. The old fashioned version is a bloke in a bow tie saying, you know, don't worry, it's going to be fine. And I don't know if that I don't think that works anymore. The old-fashioned version was the man in the bow tie telling you what's going to happen. And you say, okay, yes, yes, doctor. Hmm. I think you're much more likely to have faith and, you know, take the medicine or go for the therapy or whatever it is if it's been a conversation.
Yeah, and it's more human.
Yeah, because it's medicine's about communication. That's what the job is.
Yeah, the kind of bow tie, the authority of the bow tie wearing well-spoken gent has been destroyed over years of Tory governments. Where bow tie wearing well-spoken gents have lied to us and completely screwed everyone over. It's no longer that reliable voice anymore.
No, you run from the bowler hat, rightly so.
Yeah, exactly. It's changed now. Because again, it used to be that newsreaders, pilots was always the famous one. You want a posh in control voice to come in, a male voice and all that. And it's like, I think that stereotype is long gone because we've seen well-spoken, rich buffoons.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what bank robbers look like these days.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a bow tie rather than a stripy top and a swag bag.
Yeah, it's switched completely. Well, I mean, another thing I want to talk about, and again, it's I feel like a professional interviewer here rather than someone that just talks to people a lot. But it ties in your new book and, you know, post this is going to hurt, because when the book blew up, as you said, it was even more successful than you could have imagined. You got to tour it a lot. And I think, again, your shows and tours, you had the advantage of years of going up and down the country on stage as a stand-up, whereas a lot of authors haven't quite got that. I've been to some book tour type events that have been incredibly dry or incredibly hit and miss. Like, depends on the night, depends on what unfolds. But you had that side already, right, in your back pocket.
I mean, I don't think most authors sit down at their desk in their garret and write their novel thinking, oh, great, one day I'm going to have to stand up and, you know, in a converted church in Bath and read out loud for 20 minutes. It's like,
yeah, this bit's going to kill.
it's almost the opposite of the author mentality.
Yeah, completely.
And in fact, This Is Going to Hurt in its first iteration was a live thing. So about, how long ago was it now? 6-7 years ago now, the junior doctors went on strike. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it may be coming again. And the doctors went on strike because there was a contract being imposed on them that was unfair. And it was unfair to such an extent that it was going to affect, you know, their hours. And they were saying that it was going to be basically unsafe for patients. And that is, you know, numbers 1 to 10 on your priority list if you work in the healthcare profession. How does this impact on the patients? You know, almost always that comes for, how is that going to impact on me? And doctors have quite a quiet voice compared to the government, who've got this, you know, access to the entirety of the media. And I could see this playing out, and the government were going on the radio and saying the doctors are striking because they're being greedy and they want more money. And that was just, it was maddening. To hear. It was just a lie. And the doctors lost the battle and lost the war and ends up with this contract imposed on them. And I thought, if people knew what it was like, you know, actually working on the wards, then it would be impossible, the thought that anyone would believe anyone saying that, you know, they're in it for the cash.
Yeah.
And so I went up to the Edinburgh Fringe, where I'd been up a bunch of times before with various bits of comedy, and I stood on stage and I read out from my diaries, you know, but by the way, most of my diaries were just absolute garbage, you know. It was like, did cesarean section number 487 and stuff like that. But I found ones that I thought explain what the life of a doctor's actually like. Some of the funny stuff and silly stuff, but also some of the ways it affects you as a human, and how, you know, doctors are human. And so, and I read that out on stage, and I thought, you know, that's 100 and something people every night for 30 nights. That's a few thousand people who will never again think that doctors are greedy.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was that. But a friend of mine, Mark Watson, comedian, you know, you go and see each other's shows where you're up there, you know, support your mates. His plus one was a publisher who came up to me afterwards to say, he wasn't expecting to, you know, to be, you know, on duty and looking out for books, but said, you know, how much of this have you got? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I think I might, there might be a book in there. So it came about in a weird way, but its first presentation was live.
I love that. And I love the organic nature of that. But, and again, and also the keeping the romance of the Fringe alive, because everyone goes up to the Fringe expecting to have someone in the crowd that gives them that moment. And then so many comedians get beaten down and it doesn't happen. And there's so much competition and it's so expensive. And
I mean, the Fringe is very, you know, there needs to be a big shift in how it operates. It seems to be a money-making machine that exploits people at the start of their careers who can't afford to have, you know, and shouldn't have, you know.
Somehow that seems to have only got worse after the pandemic. It seems to have come back even harder for working class people to go up there and put on a show and make a living. It's impossible.
I think we're not far away from it being the Fringe of 50 years ago, where it was only people from a certain college in Oxford who put on a show. Because it's the, you know, I'm in a better financial position now, you know, being honest, than when I first went up there. But the costs of staying there are wincingly expensive. Mm-hmm. Like, you're paying so much for a room that you think you should have a swimming pool or like a view of the Algarve or something.
Yeah.
And this year I only went up for a few days.
I did the same. I did a couple of days and I felt, wow, I'm privileged to be able to pop here for a couple of days, because it's crazy, even that. So yeah.
It's crazy. And also the maths of it just doesn't work. So I'm touring now. I've got a new tour going around. And I went up to the Fringe for 3 nights, plus a spare one to see some other stuff, to try out my new stuff, because there's no better place. There's no better audience. You know, they love comedy. And I played in a reasonably big room. It's at the Pleasance, so like 200 seats. So in the Fringe scheme of things, that's pretty big. Actually, I think it might have been 300 seats, actually. But it was proper. And it sold out, which was nice. But it lost money. I went up for 3 days, played to 900 people in 3 nights or whatever it was. Yeah. And because of the cost of the venue and the this and the that and the accommodation and the travel, it lost money. It's like
madness, isn't it?
Yeah. But anyway, so for all the Fringe's faults, it absolutely transformed my career in every way.
Yeah. I mean,
and it probably definitely wouldn't have happened anywhere else. So,
it's a mad one, isn't it? As you said that most writers don't sit down expecting to have to speak this work out loud on a tour or whatever else. I was going to say most writers also don't sit down and expect their work to be turned into an amazing TV show, but that is more and more the norm these days of one of the goals of trying to make a success of things. So how was it when This Is Going to Hurt got picked up by the BBC, and how was that just to work on and to get through? Because I watched it earlier this year. I took a while to get it watched, but it was perfect because it was far enough away from reading the book. And then Ben Whishaw is just a national treasure already. And I just thought, yeah, it was astounding. It all felt fresh and just was, it was perfect.
Oh, it's really kind of you to say. It wasn't, I mean, I don't think I had an adaptation in my mind when the book came out. You know, you sometimes read a book like a crime book, and which is a lot of what I read is crime. I love all that stuff. And, you know, you get to the end and there's a cliffhanger and, you know, you can already picture it on the screen. And that's, you know, that's the end of the episode, or that's when we go into the ads. Because my book was in one person's voice and, you know, was basically a few hundred little chunks of anecdote.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a natural adaptation. And so it involved sort of slightly rethinking what it would be. And ultimately, I needed to decide what I wanted it to be about. Like, pick some aspect of the experience of being a doctor and zoom in. And so I zoomed in on a particular time as a doctor where I was sort of somewhere in the middle. I had people underneath me, there were people above me. And I wanted to tell the story, a bit like we were talking about before, about mental health. Mental health of doctors is a big taboo. And this is a huge spoiler for the show. So so start, you know, whatever you do. Mute for 10 seconds now if you've not seen it and you want to. But towards the end of the series, there's a suicide of a junior doctor. And that was the first scene that I wrote, and I knew it all had to lead up to that, and then how it all paid off afterwards, as I wanted to turn something that was an absolute taboo that never gets spoken about into something unavoidable that we pumped into millions. I think 8 million people watched the first episode. And, you know, what a privilege to have the chance to explore that. And that's all thanks to the BBC. No one's got reach like the BBC. And, you know, much like the NHS, they're these big, underfunded, unwieldy, imperfect, but still wonderful institutions.
And essential institutions.
Yeah.
The thing, not, I mean, it sounds like I'm going to get a flag out, but the things that actually make Britain great. It's the BBC and the freedom and the not having to focus solely on numbers and viewership, the responsibility to be creative and push beyond just, oh, what's the biggest thing at the moment? Oh, it's reality TV. Everything has to be that whatever else. And same with the NHS, the responsibility to look after everyone and not just those.
The purity of the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the NHS is the purest possible version of healthcare.
Yeah.
It's free at the point of service. It's based on your clinical need and it's never based on your bank balance. Yeah. I'm not pretending that, you know, it's perfect because we all know.
Same
it's
with the
not.
BBC. Again, it's,
exactly
it's not
the same
perfect.
With the BBC.
Yeah.
It's not perfect, but I mean, there's always an appetite to get rid of this kind of institution from people who are somehow threatened by it or have money to be made, you know, were it a different model. But I mean, we won't realise how much we miss it until it's gone.
Yeah, I completely agree. I can completely agree. Well, before we get properly into the new book, top three, four, five things you've taken out of someone? What comes to mind? What's the first things that jump out to you?
I mean, Christmas lights, which
amazing.
Isn't particularly impressive until I say that they've been turned on and caused some internal burns.
Where was I assume the plug was out already.
By the time, you know, I think by the time they headed into the car, they didn't like put it in like the cigarette lighter in the in the car to keep it going. And I think I there's some gag in the book about brings new meaning to the phrase, I put the Christmas lights up myself.
Yeah.
I mean, this is so. I do get asked about objects in orifices because obviously
we're fascinated by it, aren't we?
It's very, very funny. There's no way around it. It's definitely funny. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll be speaking to a more po-faced interviewer who will say, you know, did that really happen? That person with the, you know, toilet brush or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll say, yeah, that happened. And if I ever speak to doctors about it, they'll be like, oh, that's nothing. Here's my top five extraordinary things that I removed from a patient. It's you collect them as a doctor. It's doctor's Pokemon.
I love it. And there's a brilliant one in This Is Going to Hurt, which I won't give spoilers to because, again, I can't recommend it enough. On iPlayer, all easy to binge. Well, speaking of the book and speaking of This Is Going to Hurt, we've spoken about kind of the power. You mentioned 8 million people watching, and I think that's the power of dramatization and even sitcom or whatever else over necessarily documentaries or panorama specials and things like this. I think there is something that draws people in, and I'm binging at the moment a show called The Bear, which is absolutely amazing.
Just started it.
It's astounding. And
as
you were mentioning the where you were when the part of your story that's told in This Is Gonna Hurt, it made me think of kitchens, not just because you both wear white, because there are these hierarchies and you are hugely important to the person below you or hugely in power of the person below you and you're almost worthless to the person above you. And it's such a weird comparison. And as I said, the reason I'm linking this into the book is I found it fascinating when you touched upon something I hadn't thought of, and that's dissection. I'm saying it right.
You are
very clear
dissection,
in the book.
Not dissection,
As a lifelong vegetarian. And again, it instantly but like just thinking of kitchens as well. It's something I'd never thought about, but it's a really weird thing, right? So you would never have cut into flesh as such And
no, not all, since all I think not things. Since the age of 3 or 4.
Yeah.
That was the first, for want of a better word, meat that I had, you know, I'd used a knife on.
And easily the meat you've cut into the most is human meat. What a strange and unique thing to have as your... Not many people can make that claim.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like it. It doesn't reflect well, does it?
No, but it's...
However good my intentions, that sounds horrible.
But it's a fascinating thing because it must have... Again, it's quite a unique position. And you talk early on in the book of those student years and that kind of time and how strange and overwhelming it can be, how visceral the overwhelmingness can be of sights, of sense, of everything.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's probably magnified by the lack of steak or whatever else that you've experienced. Yeah. There's probably a level of desensitization.
Yeah, I think desensitization is why medical students, teenagers for the most part, 18-year-olds, fresh out of school, are sent into these rooms and stood round a cadaver and told, you know, make a nice big incision all the way down the, you know, front of the ribs and, you know, reflect that and remove that and saw that. You, very early on, it does two things. You stop thinking of this as a person, unfortunately, because you can't, because otherwise you would faint or vomit or something. And it encourages a sort of horrible gallows sense of humour. And everyone develops it as a coping mechanism for this, you know, it's not natural for an 18-year-old to be cutting up someone's gran. That's not right.
No.
And it's only recently that dissection has fallen off the syllabus in medical schools. But there's still a whole bunch of medical schools that still do it. Because actually, there are much better ways to know and learn human anatomy.
Right.
There's something called prosection, where an expert, you know, one expert cuts something up great and points up this ligament and this artery and that nerve and that vessel. And you can learn from 3D visualizations.
Yeah.
Like an MRI, basically, where you sort of scroll up and down slices of a body and you can learn it all that way. And there are models and there are all sorts of things. And VR is now coming in as a way of learning the body.
Wow.
But medicine was very reluctant to get rid of the dead person on a trolley route. And I think it is, like I say, because it has uses far beyond what you may or may not learn in terms of, you know, anatomical structures.
Yeah.
The way it's been taught hasn't changed a lot over the years. I talk in the book about being the first year in my medical school to get taught communication skills. And we were saying that communication is the cornerstone of medicine. It seems almost unthinkable that you could try and teach medicine without communication. And there's stories about, you know, that how that was taught and sort of, you know, interviewing actors, pretending to be patients and relatives and stuff like that. And it was all reasonably humiliating. But my main memory of communication skills was being on the wards, you know, trailing round some surgeon. You know, there's the senior doctor, then the junior doctor, and then behind them, like a row of ducklings, a few medical students. And it was time for us to all go off to a communication skills class. And I said to this consultant surgeon, I'm really sorry, we're going to have to dash off now, communication skills. And this old boy said, "You can't teach communication skills. You've either got it or you don't," which was quite telling. They're clearly... Yeah. were/are people who couldn't even understand the value of learning how to do the most basic thing a healthcare professional has to do. And doctors aren't recruited at medical school on the basis of their communication. It's all on very exclusionary things like, you know, A-level results and do you play the cello, you know, which demonstrates, I don't know what that demonstrates, and, you know, have you done work experience, which also limits the pool of people to people whose parents are mates with other doctors. And whereas what they should be doing is dropping the A-level grades. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying dropping them away completely. You need to have, you know, a certain level, and people want their doctors to have a certain, you know, level of, you know, academic ability, I guess. But you'll get a much better bunch of doctors if they better represent the patients they're seeing. The patients will much prefer speaking to someone who they can relate to. They're going to be talking about the most often the most personal, difficult, emotional things. And often patients don't say everything. You know, I'm a very bad patient. I talk a lot in the book about being a bad patient. And if I don't have the rapport with the doctor, I'm not gonna say my, you know, my Columbo thing at the end and the final thing that I actually was going to the doctor about and I've saved to the end and I'm waiting.
You're
by
waiting
the door.
For the big moment and then it never came through.
And it never comes because you're like, oh, what if they judge me or what if they're sniffy or what, you know. So I think it's so important and hopefully that's changing.
One of the things I find really fascinating about the medical world is the juxtaposition between the huge value of the experience of those senior doctors who've been there a long time, have been doing this, have seen so much, versus the younger doctors who may not have the experience, but as you're saying now, may have been taught in different ways and taught new things and new approaches, because medicine is a constantly, or it's meant to be, a constantly evolving thing, and we're meant to be constantly learning and improving. So how it's touched upon in the series and in the book, how is that to kind of live through, to be aware that there might be some things that you may know best on, but then you also have to quickly concede that there's other things that that these guys will know that you can't possibly have experienced at that early stage?
I don't think I spent a lot of my time when I was a brand new doctor thinking I knew best about anything.
Yeah.
I was mostly terrified. And one of the most useful things that I was taught in my first few weeks as a doctor was by a nurse who said, if you don't know something, tell the patient you don't know it and you're going to get help.
Amazing.
And I saw people time and time again fall foul of trying to, you know, pretend they're better than they are. And actually, the patients don't mind being told, I'm sorry, you know, I'm going to get someone else. I'm going to get my boss. Because they, you know, they appreciate the honesty. And I think it's like a lot of medical school is quite book-based.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know, it's like training to be a mechanic from manuals.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on day one, you've got your first Cortina and you're like, oh, this is different to in the book. And
and by the way, you're the pit team on a race.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You've not got all day on this. You're really, this is it, get in it. Get stuck in.
And it's real deep end stuff because there is no way to learn so much of this stuff than learning on the job.
Yeah.
And by the time I qualified as a doctor, I hadn't ever put in a drip, a Venflon, back of the hand, need some fluids in, needle goes in, tube stays there, bag of water.
Yeah.
I'd never done it. And then I was doing my first night shift and had this sort of panic that I've not actually. So we were living in hospital accommodation. And one of the flats went to the ward, nicked a little box of these drip things, Venflons, they're called, and we practiced on each other.
Wow!
For a few hours, and then by the end we could do it. So the first time I had to go on the ward, for that night shift, I had now cannulated someone, put in a drip. I did have track marks up and down my arm, which wasn't the ideal look. Following that, but it's a practical job, and the other thing that there's no substitute for is what doctors refer to as like from the end of the bed. So the first assessment you make is from the end of the bed, and you just get this vibe of how sick are they.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes with experience, it logs into your the AI system in your brain that you're not even aware of. You've seen 30,000 patients over the last couple of decades, and 300 of those have been really sick, and you just spot the little tells.
Yeah.
And that's something no doctor, when they start, has got a grip on. And there'll be some people who they over worry about, and some people, much worse, they under worry about. And so that's something else. And then there's the surgical skills. By the end of my time working on labour ward, which is where I spent most of my career, I was pretty good at a cesarean section because that was the main operation I did. I think I was very sort of competent and confident there. But first time was absolutely terrifying. And I think it probably took the best part of an hour to get the baby out and everything sewn up again, because that's practical skills. It's like, it's playing the trombone. It's going to be a bloody mess the first time you chuck a trombone on your face. Yeah. And then after you've done your 10,000 hours or whatever, you can play the Johnny Briggs tune and everyone cheers.
Happy. Well, I mean, speaking of that experience, then I guess one of the things that's touched upon beautifully, again, I keep in the book and in the series, is how damaging it can be to you when it goes wrong. And you say about that instinct you get, that can be thrown off. And ever since I left HMV, which I worked in for years, I've had a recurring dream of going back there as a part-timer and having the tough balance of being a part-timer, but like responsibilities-wise, but management skills and knowledge-wise, and the weight of having to return to retail from the filthy world of show business.
Yeah.
And that's annoying, but as jobs to return to in your dreams go, it's not too harrowing. Like, retail isn't too harrowing, whereas the labour ward and the worst moments in the labour ward, or even the worst imagined potential moments in the labour ward, from the sounds of it, is a fucking horrible place to return to in your dreams and in your, you know, in your mind. So how is the kind of the coping and the support of the PTSD side of this job? Because again, I'm making this a really long question here and I apologise, but I've talked to police officers about the lack of help and guidance when it comes to PTSD. And I think the medical world is probably further behind that, I guess, right?
I would say it's pretty shocking.
Despite them possibly being a couple of offices down, like the help that you need could be within the same building.
Yeah, I mean, you're making the mistake of thinking that doctors might be good patients.
Yeah,
Doctors are the worst patients. I mean, just things I've talked about in Undoctored.
It's touched upon beautifully in Undoctored in your complete dismissal of signs.
I've ignored a spinal injury that left my right leg not working for a week.
You continued a holiday, you madman.
I did continue a holiday. It doesn't look great written down on paper, but it made sense to me at the time. And, you know, all sorts of things. And like, I sort of hoped against hope that my body would somehow sort out a urinary stone that was plaguing me. And so that's what I'm like with my physical health. How likely is it for me to seek help for my mental health? And the answer is very, very unlikely. I don't know if what I had after leaving medicine was strictly PTSD, because I never saw someone at the time to say, this is your diagnosis. And also, I don't think I was ever really concentrating that much in my psychiatry lectures in order to, you know, to make the diagnosis on myself. But I left medicine essentially after a pretty awful day at work. And, you know, as you've suggested, a bad day at work in retail isn't as bad as a bad day in work in the medical profession. And I won't go into all the details, but, you know, I was the most senior doctor working on a labour ward. All we ever want is a healthy mum plus a healthy baby. And this was one of these terrible situations where we ended up with neither thing. And I would wake up a couple of times a week, middle of the night, back in that operating theatre, you know, litres of blood, and, you know, I'm covered in a cold sweat and my heart's going hundreds of beats a minute, and I can't get back to sleep, and I don't even want to get back to sleep in case I go back to sleep and I return to that nightmare. And it plagued me, and I don't have it now. And the thing that's different now is I talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
I talk about it to professionals, and I'm very open, you know, in chats like this, whereas old me, I would make a joke or pretend there was nothing the matter. But at the time, there wasn't really an infrastructure within hospitals to help. There was no like routine debrief. The culture was simply one of, you're a bloody doctor and you bloody get on with it. Stiff upper lip, stiff drink, and off you march. And that's not enough. It's just not.
No. It's really not. And again, I think there's so many things that you touch upon that need changing or are changing. And one of the things, again, in Undoctored. I'm purposely not just kind of trying to get you to tell stories from your new book, because I think people should buy your new book and go through it. I'm kind of referencing things as much as possible and not just going, tell them about when this happened. But one of the surprisingly most heartbreaking things for me was when you're talking about the general homogenization of individuals in that world and having to, and I loathe to use this sentence and phrase, but hide your light under a bushel.
Yeah.
Because as a gay gentleman, it wasn't necessarily encouraged for that to be obvious as such. And again, it's a really weird one because, again, we've touched upon it earlier where there's certain things that it's like that shit. But then, as you also touched on, sadly, you do have to deal with the general public who can be constantly surprising with how sheltered they are or how bigoted they are, and social media will teach you that on a daily basis. So there is an element of, there was an element of me reading it going, I kind of understand that, but you kind of painting one fingernail to kind of have that little thing to say, I'm me, I'm not just this white coat person, was fucking heartbreaking to read, man.
It's medicine, I think, is quite old-fashioned in the worst meaning of the of the word, and I think referring to it as a homogenization process is spot on. People arrive at medical school from all corners of the country, from all corners of the world, with their varied experiences and accents, and over the course of 5-6 years of training, it all gets sanded down and the edges get knocked off, and everyone ends up with this kind of doctor voice. Yeah, and what you're referring to was, I think hopefully now this would be unthinkable and no one would dream of doing it. So I was on my first day working on the, you know, working as a medical, well, not working, turning up as a medical student with a, you know, and I introduced myself to the consultant surgeon, you know, all the medical students, and this arsehole kept me behind afterwards and told me that I wouldn't be going on his ward, seeing his patients with hair like I had.
Mm.
And this was pre-Facebook, so I thought there was no evidence of this haircut. But then I eventually found my young person's rail card from that era, which is published in the back of the book as my author photo. And I mean, it wasn't a strong look. It was.
I'm refreshing myself. I'm going. I've got it right here. So
yeah, on the back flap. I mean, it's sort of like frosted tips, and that was the fashion at one point.
Offensive. Yeah, yeah.
It was part of the way that I expressed myself and was, you know, tried to look a bit different. I think I looked like a sort of badly damaged waxwork of Justin Timberlake or something. But I was, but in my head, you know, that was me. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry, I'll get that sorted at the weekend. He's like, no, it's a hospital. I think you can find some scissors. And so I did my own remedial haircut in a toilet in a hospital. And that's horrible. And I spoke to someone at the medical school about it at the time, you know, a sort of pastoral person. And they said, yeah, that's not good. It's not right. But what do you want to do? Who's going to get sacked, him or you?
Yeah.
And we were basically taught in medicine the way to survive was to be quiet and mediocre.
Mm.
You know, don't make a fuss, don't complain. And that's dangerous. That's, you know, that stops people, you know, whistleblowing when they see, you know, harm and danger. It's not good. And there was even I quote a passage from a book that was written for GPs.
Going the 2012 Guide to Passing Clinical Exams. Don't worry, I made notes because it blew my mind. For any listeners who are sitting in the warmth and comfort of the thought that it was just one bad egg or a few bad eggs, I mean, the two things I noted was that it was advised Asians and African students to adopt a Scottish or Welsh accent. And gay people to make sure their mannerisms, gait and speech weren't too overtly gay.
It's not great, is it?
It's not. It's really not. And to be clear, and again, you make it clear in the book, that wasn't an NHS bit of documentation, but it was a guide that was widely used.
Yeah. And it was
mind-blowing.
Yeah, and shameful and shocking. And, you know, hopefully 10 years on from that, you know, there's much less of it. But there are still dinosaurs roaming the wards.
Yeah, it's a mad one. Well, I mean, we're getting towards the hour mark, so I'll start to...
So a quarter of the way there.
we're just beginning. I'll start to kind of go towards wrapping things up. But one of the things that came to mind, again, as we were talking earlier about what authors are expecting when they sit down to write a book, and we've spoken of the pressures of being on wards. How was the pressures of kind of following up as such? Obviously, there has been other books, but this feels like the follow-up to this is going to... Following up a book that's that big and that successful, out of nowhere kind of thing, and following up a book that got turned into a TV series. So there's always that pressure of, are you writing a book? Are you writing series two? Are you writing series three or four? You know, there's a lot of different things there. And to put your mind at ease, it reads as someone who's sitting down to write another book and that's it. So it's beautiful that none of those pressures come across. But they're real, man. Like, when you've had that, like, you sitting down to write this is very different to you sitting down to write this is going to hurt.
That's absolutely true. And I'm so grateful to my editor and everyone at my publishers for never putting pressure on me to do anything other than write the book I want to write and and something from the heart that means something to me that I would be proud to, to have conversations about. Because I think in the creative industries, you know, in whatever medium, anything that's generated cynically, you can sniff that a mile off. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to, write a book that was designed by a marketing department about what the people who like that old book are going to want to read now. So it's different in a lot of ways. And, it's got some, there are some similarities, and hopefully the humour and some of the, the darkness and some of the sadness, is shared. But the pressure is relieved a bit by actually the success of This Is Going to Hurt, because chances are nothing I do in my life will have that level of, it was such a big thing in the world of nonfiction that for me to exceed that would be that's winning the lottery twice.
Yeah.
And so I'm proud of what I wrote. It's very honest and personal, as well as hopefully shining a light on some bigger issues that affect not just doctors, but also I realized when I was writing it that there's a lot of people who think about blowing their life up. And I wonder if that increased during the pandemic. Yeah. And asking the question, what happens when you do press the fuck it button, and what life looks like the day, the week, the month, the year after that, because it's not always smooth sailing. But I think if you're doing something that isn't right for whatever reason, and for me it was the job was destroying me, I think, a bit. It's also for people who wonder what life would be like if you do change every aspect of it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there's so many people that have jobs that they see as a means to an end, and that's absolutely fine, but you have to at least have the end part on the table, have the option of going, right, I'm going to walk away from this, actually. This is going to end. And it might not be. It might end up that this is what you do want to keep doing, and it's comfortable and whatever else. But you have to have that there to go, well, actually, maybe now's the time to press the fuck it button, as you say.
Life should be a choose-your-own-adventure book rather than just page one through to page 75, then get your gold carriage clock and retire and downsize to a bungalow. And
you'd be surprised how many times you can keep your thumb in the page and turn back and go, all right, no, that didn't work. Let's go back.
Yeah. My career trajectory looks absolutely bananas. Yeah. No one would plan that. I suspect, I don't know what being a careers advisor looks like these days, but it must be different, very different to when we were at school. Yeah. And the expectation is you do one of these approved list of 15, 20 jobs and you do it for 40 years and then you stop.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know what my next move is going to look like, but I do know that it has to be something that I enjoy, or it, you know, it gives me something in return. And you're the same. You're a chameleon.
Yeah. It's why I've turned down numerous times doing speeches at events or at student things where they want me to advise on careers. It's like, I've never had a clue what the fuck I'm doing, man. I can't get up there and lie to them either. And it's not the best advice. You know, it can be equally damaging to say, throw everything away and just go for it, because that'll work for some people. It'll ruin the lives of others. I don't want to be the one that's made them do that. I'll say, here's what I did, but yo, you do you. I'm not the guy there. But speaking of walking away from things, one of the things I really was excited to talk to you about was leaving in silence. Mm. And it's resonated throughout my lives, from jobs. We used to call it the office space because of the film Office Space, where he just decides to stop going to work today.
Yeah.
And that's it. He doesn't quit. He doesn't turn. He just stops going in. But I'm a big fan of it at parties, at social events, just...
Oh, every wedding.
Not making
every
a big
wedding
deal.
I've ever been to. Yeah.
I literally had it at a wedding last weekend, and my mum was there and was like, oh, you're leaving? Well, we'll go around and say goodbye to everyone. I'm like... It's
absolutely
not a big deal
not.
That I'm leaving. It's not a big deal that I'm leaving. I'm not, it's not my day. You know,
yeah.
So I'm a
if
big fan of
leaving.
Yeah.
Then
we should all be aware. We should give a little clap, but I'm good. But yeah, how big a part of your life has that been, I guess, the joy of walking? As I said, you left after a horrible day and you kind of didn't go back as such. It was kind of, yeah.
Well, I limped on for a bit.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about, you know, under investigating versus over investigating and what's bad. After I left medicine, I was a terrible doctor because I intervened too much.
Right.
So I thought, I can never have a disaster on labour ward ever again. And that means at the first sign of anything looking remotely, you know, abnormal, the tiniest thing on a baby's heart tracing on a labour ward, I'd be like, right, what do you reckon to a cesarean? Let's call this a day, you know, and get everyone out. And that's not being a good doctor.
No.
That's being a bad doctor, you know.
It's against that intuition that you spoke about earlier, that end of the bed.
Yeah, and I'd stopped trusting myself. But the truth was, and the thing that as soon as I realised made me think, actually, I do need to, you know, quietly walk towards the door, was that sometimes, every few years, through no one's fault, however good you are, if you're working on that labour ward as the doctor, you will have some kind of big disaster. It's not about the hours you've put in or how good you are, however many qualifications you've got. It's just the grim fact of the job. And people would tell me that to make me feel better, to make me realise that, you know, that was just awful luck and it doesn't reflect on you. It doesn't mean you need to change your practice or whatever. But it made me realise that I couldn't face that ever happening again because my armour wasn't thick enough and my coping mechanisms, I'd never been taught an actual coping mechanisms, a mechanism. I had white wine for after work and diaries for, you know, after work or, you know, in little gaps. And that helps a bit, but it's just not enough. And so that's when I made my exit.
And some will argue that the negative of walking away without fanfare is the kind of, and you touch upon it in Undoctored, is the mythology of the reason you walked away, of what happened, of how you left, because they didn't see you go out the door. Were you dragged out kicking and screaming? I'd argue the opposite. That's the benefit of it. You get to have this weird mythical, I left. And again, it's like, and there's a moment in the book where you bump into someone, an ex-colleague, and there is this kind of, I heard this happened. It's like, oh, right, no, none of that. But in my mind, that's
a
good thing.
Story.
Enjoy yourselves, guys. Yeah, go to town.
Yeah. But doctors don't like the idea, or certainly didn't, like the idea of other doctors leaving.
Yeah, so they need that. They need it to be something going horrendously wrong.
I needed to have gone absolutely cuckoo.
Yeah.
There's no other way of rationalising it.
I've had people argue with me, and again, not to compare being a touring musician to being a doctor, but I've had people argue with me online before that when I stopped doing music, I had someone say, look, it's okay if you're scared of failure. Like, you can still make... I'm like, no, I'm not. I was just finished. I really loved it. I loved it all and went away on top. It's like, look, I know you're scared, but we believe that you can do another. It's like, dude, stop telling me that I've walked away because I'm scared I've lost it or I haven't got the skill. It's like, no, yeah. I walked away because I thought I wasn't going to get a better exit. I had a moment where I went, this is pretty much, as you said, this is as good as it's going to get. I'm going to go over here now and try something else. But people will have their own reasons at all times, you know?
Yeah, leave them wanting more.
Yeah.
Although, as the old joke goes, that's not great if you're an anaesthetist.
Well, that's a perfect note to wrap things up on. And I want to know, like, what is ahead? Obviously, Undoctored, the story of a medic who ran out of patience, is either out now as this comes out or is available.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's out. It's available. So what's ahead? What's the plan? Obviously, you've done amazing things in TV now. You've done amazing things in live shows now. You know, what's your focus?
I do lots of different things to keep myself interested. So I'm touring at the moment. Got a show called This Is Gonna Hurt More, which is, you know, some of the good stuff from the first book, plus a lot of stuff from Undoctored. I'm writing a kid's book at the moment. So I've done a couple of kids' books, which I love because, again, nonfiction. I've basically got the sense of humour of a 8 to 12-year-old. So it works really well. I just take out the occasional swear word, and it's pretty much exactly how I write for adults.
I do.
So there's that, and I'm brewing a new TV thing, which is not yet cooked, but when it is, I will tell you all about it.
I love it. Well, I'm excited for all that's ahead, particularly if I can consume any of it in a pizza restaurant in Portugal. Thank you for taking the time, man. I'm really pleased that this came around. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Me too. I've had a lovely time. Cheers. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Adam Kay. I hope you enjoyed that. As I said, if you didn't read This Is Going to Hurt, can't recommend it enough. If you didn't watch it, it's on iPlayer. You're going to adore that. And if you've not read Undoctored yet, again, can't recommend it enough. I just can't recommend Adam enough. Follow him on Twitter. Do all the things. I'll be back next week with another wonderful guest, another person who I've enjoyed on Twitter an awful lot, but we'll get to that next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.